Hello, I'm Joseph Batty, and welcome to episode 2 of Chitavritti. Today, we are going to talk about vrittis, right knowledge, and mantra meditation. So stay tuned. Vrittis literally means vortex or a circular motion with no beginning or no end. Just like our thoughts that never end, they just keep going around and around. There are 4 components of vritti: knowledge, reaction, feeling, and memory. So the knowledge component here means that we have knowledge or the understanding of how we normally interact with others in our life. And reaction is, of course, how we react to everyday things, situations, and people. Whether it's pleasure, pain, happiness, or frustration. The third is feeling. How a situation makes you feel. This can be a positive, negative, or just a neutral emotion to it. And it is definitely colored by the gunas. So depending on what gunas you're wearing, tamoguna, rajaguna, or sattvaguna, that determines your mood, your state of mind, your mood at that moment. And those moods and whichever guna is dominant right now is how you're going to react to things. The fourth component is memory. We have the memory of past events and how they made us feel or act towards something, and can become guidelines for future reaction of that object or person. Other than the 4 components, vrittis can, like we discussed last week, can be put in 5 different categories. As we touched on, these categories are right knowledge, wrong knowledge or error, imagination, sleep, and memory. Right knowledge comes from direct sense perception, inference, and trusted sources. The Yoga Sutra commentators tell us that direct perception is above all the other ways to gain right knowledge. By direct sense perception, there is no susceptibility of error, because we have gained the knowledge through direct senses. We've either saw it or heard it or felt it directly. We were there. Next is inference, or the ability to know that because this object always does the same thing and never deviates from it, you can infer, or you know, that this thing will always have this particular outcome. The classical example is this. Since you see smoke in the forest, there must be a fire, because smoke is always made, for the most part, always made by fire. The third way to gain right knowledge is through a trusted source. The commentators of the sutras defines a trustworthy person as someone who cannot be contradicted and are free from defects. Basically, the sutras define a trustworthy person as someone who you don't feel like is going to lie to you, who you feel like is going to tell you the truth no matter what. And the third trusted source of right knowledge is verbal testimony or sacred scripture. Just like Patanjali's, who wrote the Yoga Sutras in order for us to gain knowledge about yoga. It's sacred because it has proven to be a trusted source. Meditation does work. It's been proven over thousands of years of experimentation and implementation. In yoga psychology is a wonderful and proven way to look at the world and to interact with the world and to be a better person. The next category is error. Error is something that's considered to be what is not. A classic example for error is identifying a rope with a snake. A rope is never a snake, but perceiving the rope as a snake is error. To remove this error, or to remove any error, you must use true knowledge. By knowing the rope is only a rope, you have eradicated the error. So basically, overcoming error is applying true knowledge to it, or right knowledge, I should say. The third vritti category is imagination. This one is strange and may be interpreted different ways. Imagination is the use of words that are devoid of an actual object. For instance, sayings like time flies or the sun sets. There's no physical entity named time, and he is definitely not flying. And the sun doesn't really set or rise. It's just the rotation of the earth going around its axis. Unlike error in right knowledge, there is no error in judgment here. The object just simply doesn't exist. And the fourth is deep sleep. It is considered a vritti because you can dream and wake up and remember what you dreamed. You can remember you have slept well or not at all. And people have said that so-and-so, or maybe their god, or maybe a person who has died, has come to him in their dream, and that dream has changed their life. So that does tell us that sleep is a vritti, and it could have beneficial effects for your life. And the last is memory. Memories are pratyayas that get stored in your citta. And a sequence of pratyayas become a vritti. And vrittis that are stored in your memory are called samskaras or imprints. These samskaras can be retrieved at any time through an experience, such as when things remind you of something. And that samskara becomes a vritti with all the emotions and feelings and thoughts processes that were attached to it when you first experienced it. And all the vrittis that are stored and become karma come from the klesas. To understand this better, I'm going to paraphrase from Yoga Sutras by Edwin Bryant. Thus, right knowledge can be used to dispel the klesas of ignorance. Discrimination of the difference between Purusha, the real self, and Prakriti can dispel the klesas of ego. Detachment dispels the klesas of attachment and aversion, since they are the two sides of the same coin. And the realization of the eternality of the soul dispels the klesas of clinging to life. So I'm sure everyone has heard the Me Too movement by now. It is, of course, the movement of women speaking out about sexual abuse and sexual misconduct that's happened to them in society or the workplace. Most of the women speaking out about this, they're doing it against people of power, maybe their boss or a higher-ranking official. But for the most part, it's been people that have power over them in some way. So why do people in power act this way? So I think, and a lot of this, or some of this, I should say, is just my own opinion. You know, everyone's got opinions. I'm not going to get too deep into the Me Too movement. I'm just using this to frame some yoga philosophy and bring it into context. Hopefully I won't fail too miserably at this. So corporate and political power in today's Western society is normally given, and it's not earned. Most people of power get their power because they're good at playing the game. They're good at selling themselves. They're good at networking, meeting all the right people. And it's because they're good at that aspect is the reason why they get the better jobs, the higher paying jobs, and eventually get jobs of power where they're over people. They're leading divisions or whole corporations. This aspect of Western society is one reason, in my opinion, that we have such awful leaders. They don't earn their leadership. There's no legitimacy to rule, especially in the political world. So this type of power, to me, and in my opinion, is false power. It's false power because there's no real legitimate right to rule or be the leader of the corporation, because they have not been elected really by peers, not even in our political system today. We think that they're elected by us, but do we really know that? No, we don't. We don't sit there and count the ballots. We're trusting that the people working there are doing it properly. And when we go to vote, the people that we the people actually want to vote for aren't on the ballot. Everyone says, well, I got to pick the best of the two worst people that could possibly be the candidate, so I'll pick, you know, this person instead of this person. So they don't have true legitimate right to rule in Western society. Not in corporations, because they're not being voted on by their peers. They're just mainly networking and going to the proper parties and meeting the right people and being chummy with the right people to get their job. And they're not getting it through merit and hard work. And that's true also in politics, where the people who are qualified for the job never get it. And so that, to me, is false power. It's power predicated on a lie. Now, what is true power? To me, true power, it is earned by the way of hard work, respect of your peers, qualified to do the job at the highest level possible, and have a proven track record that you can do your job. And also, you should be psychologically ready to fulfill that job. If it's a very demanding job, we don't want a psychologically unstable person to be doing that job. I'm not going to name names, but there definitely is people that are unfit to be running this country and a lot of the corporations that are in this country. So what makes a good leader versus a bad leader? In my opinion, one of the key things that differentiates a good leader from a bad leader is perception. At the end of the day, we are all just human beings. All people react to their current situation based on past experiences, embedded samskaras in your chitta. For instance, if you had a bad upbringing, a bad boss, or just been mistreated your whole life, so the vrittis that are going to come up in any corporate situation where there's problems is going to be different from that person who's had, you know, just lucked up and just has had good mentors and good bosses and good people to lead them in on the correct path. A lot of people don't get that these days. They just kind of have to figure it out as they go. And some of the people they're looking up to isn't people they should be looking up to. A good leader always has true power because they respect their employees or their constituents, and a good leader is normally been appointed by his peers and respected in that position because everyone knows he's going to do a good job. The good leader is not out to, you know, fire them for any reason or put them in bad situations, such as putting an employee that's a female in a situation with someone that is prone to sexual misconduct. So a bad leader is normally one that is selfish, greedy, and live mainly within tamaguna or rajaguna. And because they're really good at playing the game and meeting the right people and talking to the right people and being around the right people, that is more important to them than Joe Schmo in cubicle 4 that's, you know, had a really bad day and really needs to get out of work on time. But hey, the boss don't care. You know, you gotta sit here till your job is done, no matter what. Well, that's not a good leader. That's not a good boss. That's just being a bad person and focusing on the wrong things. Your perception of what you need to be doing is focused as a bad leader, is focused on networking. What's in it for me? What am I going to get out of this? How much money am I going to make? When he should be focusing on his employees, you know, Bob in cubicle 4, hey, he's had a bad day, man. Take the rest of the day off. Take your work with you. If you can do it at home, man. Just have a good day. A good leader knows that if his employees are happy, they're going to do a way better job than if there is fear of being let go, or if you're a woman in the corporate environment, fear of being hit on, or fear of not being taken seriously because you're a woman. If you know that you're going to be taken seriously and that your boss has your back, that is a good leader. So yoga tells us how to attain right knowledge and gain the correct perspective. And as we said in the beginning, that is through inference, direct perception from your senses, through a trusted source. So if knowledge that is worthy to act upon was not gained through the yoga definition of how to attain right knowledge, then by definition, it is wrong knowledge or error or imaginary knowledge or imagination. So I hope this helps you this week. I intentionally leave some of it a little vague because in order to really deeply understand this, there has to be some thinking involved. You have to contemplate and meditate on the things that I'm saying, especially from the Yoga Sutras. And when you have to really meditate on something and contemplate it and think about it, it really solidifies it in your mind. Mantras are by far my favorite way to meditate. Mantras are practiced to make the mind one-pointed and to quieten the mind's distracting behavior. My favorite mantra is the Om mantra. I do it maybe a little differently than some people do or what I have saw. I recite the three syllables of Om, and while I'm reciting the three syllables, I say to myself, in the first syllable, awake, in the second syllable, dreaming, and in the third syllable, deep sleep. And of course, there actually is four syllables, and the fourth syllable is the silence after the I got this from the Mandukya Upanishad. However, you can try any mantra you would like. Find one that really speaks to you and get in the practice of saying it every day and really focus on each syllable and how you actually say each syllable, and it will, over time, you will gain one-pointedness. You'll be able to focus and concentrate more on one thing. So that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something from it. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe, and share on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast, or wherever you listen to podcasts.